It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds. This week, we're taking some time to talk with U.S. military veterans about that transition from military life back to civilian life. Today, playwright Major David Tucker. He joined the Army Reserves in 1982. He was deployed to Haiti in 1994 and Kosovo in 2000. David Tucker spoke with Marcy Silman about his final deployment.
We arrived in Kuwait on April 15th, and then we convoyed up to Baghdad and arrived in Baghdad on May 1st, which was the mission accomplished day by President Bush at the time. So that's the day that we arrived, and we saw that there was still a lot of work to be done, and combat operations hadn't actually ceased. So the initial reception, in a lot of ways, was very supportive because of the fact that we had removed a dictator who'd been extremely oppressive. And so the people were very supportive, but then, in the weeks and months to follow, they very soon begin to look at you as though, at what point are you leaving? And we weren't for many, many years, and we anticipated that. I say from the soldiers on the ground. I don't say that from the higher leadership, because obviously there wasn't the post-hostility operational plans in place. As after you take Baghdad, what do you do next? Those plans were not in place, and it was very frustrating for us who had to implement those actions.
Well, so you had to implement something that was coming from
that didn't exist.
Yeah.
That didn't exist. So we had to create it. Because you have to succeed, you have to still fulfill the mission. And so we had to say, what is our mission and what are we trying to do here? And so that's what we did.
Well, I mean, your job was to lead. Correct. How many people?
I had 92 soldiers that we took into theater.
When you realized, oh gosh, we've got to make this up and on our own, did you allow yourself to have emotions about what position you had been put in?
Well, you have emotions throughout this entire experience, but what you have to do is, in a lot of ways, put those aside, because it's you have a responsibility to your soldiers and you have a responsibility to the task that's been given you. And so you have to overcome those things that are setting you up for potential failure. But the challenge is that you've got a 1st Armored Division, which is a tank organization primarily, and they're used to conventional warfare. So now you put a tank division in an urban environment, which is not the best environment for them, and you're telling them to get out of your tanks, patrol on foot, and they don't have the skill set of looking for insurgents, because that's not what they're trained to do. And the thing is that it's not so much that they didn't do a good job at trying to suppress the hostilities, but the problem is that you also have to maintain the population support at the same time. And you've got to make sure that the actions you're taking don't end up alienating them and turning a very neutral neighborhood into an anti-American neighborhood. Insurgency means that the insurgents are among the population. So it's very hard to tell friend to foe. And so that was the biggest challenge we had, because all of a sudden we're starting to see, which was a brand new method of warfare, which was the IEDs, and they would hide them in garbage. They would hide them in dead dog bodies. You know, these things that you would not associate as a threat necessarily, all of a sudden were exploding around you. And so I remember in July, which is when we really started getting hit with a lot of IEDs, for 3 weeks, every time I went outside, because we had Humvees that had no armor. Not just no armor, we had canvas Humvees, meaning that, there was no protection of any sort. So I told my soldiers, take the doors off, because they're not going to protect you, and we have to be able to roll out of these vehicles if there's a grenade thrown in them. And you need, and so we had no protection, and we had no body armor. You know, we had no the Kevlar plates that we should have had, because that was the supply chain, just didn't happen. So we had no protection in any regard. So I would say for the first 3 weeks in July, you get in these thoughts in your head of, I'm going to get killed today, I'm going to get killed, I'm going to get killed. It's very unnerving. And then you get to a point, or at least I did, where you just have to say the heck with it. Because either it happens or it doesn't happen, because you can't live with that sustained fear endlessly to where something doesn't change. And what you have to change is your perspective on it, in terms of, it becomes very black and white. Either you're alive or you're not. And so you have to adjust your sense of perspective and your sense of what fate is in terms of either it happens or it doesn't happen.
I'm imagining as you tell me this, David, of like drawing a curtain down in a part of your brain and just blocking off a whole part of how you experience life as a human.
Well, you have to, in a lot of ways, put those emotions aside and focus on the task at hand, because if you just sit there and wallow in the swirl of your own emotions all the time, then you don't get anything done. So it doesn't mean you don't have emotions. And I've always had to try to tell this to my own sons, is that, you know, being strong or doing something you don't want to necessarily do doesn't mean you don't have feelings about it. But it just means that you focus on what needs to be done, when it needs to be done, and then deal with the emotions when you can afterwards. The problem is that when you're in a combat zone for 11, 12 months, that afterwards can take a long time.
I'm talking with David Tucker. He's a retired Army major. Retired, right?
Correct.
12 months? I thought you were there for longer than a year.
I was gone for 13 months, but I was in country, actually in Baghdad for 11 months.
You mentioned two sons. You had a family when you were deployed.
Yes, I left my home in February 2003 and returned basically, I think, early to late April 2004. So my youngest son was 6 months old. My oldest son was at that time 4 years old. And so the challenge was, when you come back after 13 months being gone, essentially, you come back and you know, when a soldier leaves, it sometimes leaves like a wound in the family, and that family has to continue on and has to survive. And so that wound scars over and heals and survives and as it needs to. The challenge is that when you're deployed, all you think about is getting home. And then when you come home, it's not the home you left 13 months ago, because you're now on the outside looking in. That family has gotten used to you not being there. It gets very frustrating, because you come home and you realize, I don't necessarily belong here either.
Well, you've also just spent 11 or 12 months with that curtain drawn down. As you said, you know, that sense, either I'm going to live or I'm going to die. Which is not the way that most civilians go about their daily lives. So
right.
You've got the family issue, but you also have the internal changes. I don't know how temporary those can be. I don't know.
You know, for me, I think it took me 2 years to kind of what I consider land in some ways. And that means just kind of get back into a civilian mode. The challenge is that The challenge is that you come home. So just to kind of finish that thought,
right.
You come home and my youngest didn't know who I was.
Because he was 6 months old.
Because he was 6 months old. And so now he was, you know, one and a half, almost two. And he doesn't know who I am, essentially, except from some photographs. And my oldest, you know, I was getting back. I had to go back to California, where my unit was based. And I remember getting on the plane just before I was getting on the plane at the airport. And I'd just been home like maybe a couple of weeks. And he said, "Are you going again?" And I said, "Why?" He said, "I'm just going to be gone for a week. I'll be back in a week. I have to take care of some stuff to close out my command." And he was really upset. And I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "Because you last time you left when I was four, you didn't come back until I was five." And then I realized that this isn't just about me. You know, this is about the impact on my children, on the family life. And that was one of the key decisions in terms of retiring, because I'd been in the military for 22 years at that point. So it definitely impacts a family in ways that you don't anticipate. And it impacts a soldier. When you feel you're on the outside of your own family, you don't feel like there's a home. And the tough thing is that sometimes the home you feel most comfortable in is the home you just left, which is Baghdad. So the challenge becomes, at least from my standpoint, is that you're in a combat environment, and all the things that we kind of assume are PTSD indicators or behavior, such as hypervigilance, you know, reacting to loud noises, those are all survival mechanisms in a combat zone. So from the combat zone standpoint, those are natural, and those are actually what keep you alive. You come to Seattle, let's say, because I was at Fort Bragg, and then I was 10 days later, I was on the streets of Seattle after just having been in Baghdad. And you come home, and the challenge is the things, your behavior is out of step with the people around you, and you sense it, but you don't know why.
So you have the family that has healed without you so that they can function. You go back to the Seattle Repertory Theater, right?
You go back
to this job that's nothing like the job you were doing for a year in Baghdad. What was that part of life like for you, that reentry?
Well, I was very lucky in one regard, and that was a very good close friend of mine who just recently passed away, Jerry Manning. He was there, and you know, it was funny that we were friends before I departed for Iraq, but when I came back, he was really the person that I could lean into, because I was struggling with I was being asked constantly, what was the war like? What was the experience like? And I didn't want to talk about it. I had no desire to talk about it. And he said, I wanted to explain to the people I cared about without having to explain to the people I cared about. And so he said, write about it.
We should say, interject here, that you were a playwright before you left.
Yes.
In addition to working at Seattle Repertory Theater. So when Jerry Manning said to you, write about it, he meant write a play, not write in a journal.
Correct. He said, write what you can and write it in the way that you feel like the story should be told. And that was extremely helpful and very hard and very painful at the same time. We weren't doing it as therapy, but, you know, in a lot of ways, it helped to get that the feelings and the war inside me outside me, you know. And so so that I could have a little bit of a standoff distance and get a little different perspective. Doesn't mean I could ever let go of those things, but it just helped to kind of see them in a different way.
Are you still writing your own?
I am, actually. The Seattle Rep is doing a reading of one of my plays in September, on September 9th. It's called North Wind Blowing. It's a play with music, and it takes place in 1930s Americana.
So it's not about your experience as in a war zone?
No, because I don't, you know, war, it's like a lot of key events in your life. You know, you can either let it define you, or you just simply let it become part of the mosaic of your life. And so my whole, you know, it'll always be a part of me, but I don't want it to also define solely who I am.
David, thank you so much for coming by.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me.
Seattle-based playwright, photographer, novelist, educator, and retired soldier, David A. Tucker. He spoke to KUOW's Marcy Silman. Major Tucker continues to write, and he works with soldiers who've returned home to help them write about their experiences. You can find all of our interviews with returning soldiers at KUOW.org. This is The Record.